Hello and welcome to Be the Change, the latest podcast from the Climate Clinic, a brand new series brought to you by the Global Consortium on Climate and Health Education. We now know that healthcare contributes to the climate crisis and makes up more than 4.4% of net global climate emissions. The health sector must be a societal leader in protecting public and planetary health from climate change. In order to do this, it needs to decarbonize rapidly, build resilience and adaptive capacity, as well as fostering health equity and meeting global goals, including universal health coverage. In this series, we'll be talking with experts from around the world in order to shine light on exactly what you can do in your communities today. Welcome back to another episode of Be the Change. I'm delighted to be joined in the studio today by Dr. Alex Wilkinson. Alex completed his undergraduate medical training at Cambridge University before qualifying in clinical medicine from Oxford University in 2005. His main specialist clinical interests include lung infection, bronchiectasis, and tuberculosis. Dr. Wilkinson works nationally with the British Thoracic Society as the lead on sustainable respiratory care, and is also an associate of the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare in Oxford. He has numerous publications in this field and is particularly interested in reducing the environmental impact of inhaled medications. Alex, I'm really looking forward to discussing with you exactly how respiratory care has been impacting the environment over the years and what it needs to be doing going forwards in order to mitigate and adapt to the threats posed by climate change. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved with sustainability and healthcare.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for inviting me. As you say, I'm an NHS respiratory consultant, so that's my main job, working in a busy district general hospital. But I've been interested in the climate crisis, as many of us have, and what can be done to help reduce our impact, negative impact on the environment. And came to the realization that respiratory medicine has so many links with the environment, both ways. You know, so much of our lung health is related to the air that we breathe, but also the medicines that we use in respiratory care can have a big climate impact as well.
And when we talk about respiratory care and how it impacts the environment, it's sort of a bi-directional relationship, which our listeners are familiar with now, because we've covered sort of exactly how the changing climate is affecting our respiratory health. But tell us a little bit about the main routes through which respiratory care has been affecting the environment historically.
So, I mean, historically, I think probably the most interesting one is the impact on the ozone layer. I mean, in general, you know, the environmental impact of healthcare follows the money. So the more expensive something is, the more waste it produces, the bigger impact it has on the environment. But there are some exceptions to that rule, and the big one is pressurized metered dose inhalers. So there's the most common sort of inhaler, where you've got a spray can that you press down into a plastic container that sprays the medicine out into patients' lungs. And so they used to contain CFCs, which were depleting the ozone layer. And through massive concerted effort via the Montreal Protocol, CFCs were phased out completely, which has been really the most impressive example, I think, of global cooperation on an environmental issue that has quite literally saved the planet. The world is about one degree warmer than it would be were it not for human impact on the climate. But had we not intervened on these CFCs, the planet would be locked into about 3 degrees of global warming already. So historically, that's the big change that we've had. We replaced the CFCs in these metered dose inhalers with hydrofluorocarbons, which don't deplete the ozone layer. But they're like CFCs, they're powerful greenhouse gases. They're actually less powerful greenhouse gases than CFCs, but still between 1,400 and about 3,500 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. So they still have a very significant greenhouse gas impact. We recently did a study looking at the overall carbon footprint of asthma care. And surprisingly, in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions, the metered dose inhalers totally dominated everything. So about 60% of the carbon footprint of asthma care is due to the blue reliever inhalers. And another about 30% is due to the preventer inhalers, the sort of steroid inhalers that are used to try and control the disease. And then the other bits are relatively small. So the primary care reviews, the treatment of exacerbations in hospital, you know, the intensive care side of things make up smaller sort of 2-4% of the overall carbon footprint. So these are important factors, but much less important than the greenhouse gas emissions from metered dose inhalers. Now, the other thing we found was that if your asthma is well controlled, then the carbon footprint of your care is about one third that if you've got poorly controlled asthma. And that's largely due to your reliance on the blue reliever inhalers. If you've got poorly controlled asthma, you need a lot of blue reliever inhalers. Whereas if you've got well controlled asthma, you're using less of those inhalers, less greenhouse gas emissions, but of course, you know, fewer hospital stays, you know, fewer need of steroid rescue packs as well, and so these other aspects of waste go alongside that.
It really comes back to prevention being the fundamental tool that we're going to have to reduce our emissions across most different sort of healthcare specialties. We had a chat with Ray Van Holder a few weeks ago looking at kidney care, and you know, he was going into the fact that prevention is going to be critical here, whilst transplantation is meteorically better in terms of its overall emissions as a process to hemodialysis and environmental impact. Prevention and preventing our patients from reaching the point of requiring renal replacement therapy is going to be critical. And it sounds like you're saying it's something similar with respiratory care, in that whilst we're seeing an increase in sort of presentations of childhood asthma, so on and so forth, as a result of environmental change, including air pollution, it's going to be key to prevent these patients from requiring a reliever inhaler and over-dependence on these modalities of treatment.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, we definitely need to do more, do as much as we can to prevent the ongoing increases in asthma prevalence that we're seeing, and we know we do have some strategies that can be effective in that way. You talked about air pollution, which is absolutely a key factor. You know, reducing smoking as well, you know, proper antimicrobial stewardship, and other factors that involve, you know, generate a healthy microbiota, like breastfeeding, vaginal delivery, addressing workplace exposures to allergens as well. All these factors can help prevent exacerbations. But once you've got established asthma, then emphasizing good controller therapy in a way that, you know, really follows guidelines and escalates care appropriately to ensure patients are getting the disease under control and not just relieving the symptoms, is really vital for good quality care and low carbon care.
When it comes to respiratory care, what are the exact steps that are currently being taken and sort of the initial priorities within this specialty? And secondly, can you share any examples of respiratory care facilities or units that have been successful in already implementing these changes?
If I were to highlight units or strategies that have worked really well, I think, you know, one way to look at it is to look at our European neighbours, who use far greater proportions of combination dry powder controller medication. And consequently, they've got far smaller carbon footprint of care. We see far lower levels of reliance on blue relievers amongst our European neighbours as well, and better rates of asthma control. You know, one of the big success stories has probably been Finland, and they've really focused on the last few decades on prioritising anti-inflammatory treatments for asthma. You know, very often the first inhaler the patient gets is the blue reliever inhaler. So they come to think, okay, this is the most important thing in my care. You know, it quickly relieves my symptoms. This is the inhaler I need all the time. When in fact, if you've got asthma and airway inflammation, then getting on top of that inflammation needs to be the priority, and starting with inhaled steroids. And, you know, international guidelines, such as the GINA guidelines for asthma, no longer recommend using salbutamol alone because they think it's unsafe, and recommend starting with a combination inhaler with a fast-acting reliever like formoterol and an inhaled steroid alongside it. It's starting with these sorts of combination inhalers. And I think that's a strategy that's got great potential to improve care and reduce carbon footprint of care.
Those are some fantastic points and examples that you've shared with us, Alex. Thank you. And I suppose your take home, if I've not mistaken you here, is from the success stories that you've cited as well, is potentially a lower threshold to consider that early intervention with low dose inhaled corticosteroids of some sort at the beginning following diagnosis, if I've not mistaken what you've said.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've sort of focused on asthma, but you know, that there are important lessons in COPD as well, because very often with COPD, you know, the first step is we think about the blue reliever inhaler, when actually what are the most effective treatments in COPD? Well, the first one absolutely is smoking cessation. Patients now know that smoking is bad for them. Everyone knows that. What patients need is help to quit and support to quit through effective treatment and counselling and support. And if they're not ready to quit, can we help them cut down as part of a cut down to quit strategy? Are we educating patients on the role of vapes if they're unable to quit as well, and the potential benefits of using electronic cigarettes instead of tobacco for those patients who can't quit or don't want to use nicotine replacement therapy? So, you know, that's number one treatment. Number two treatment is pulmonary rehabilitation, you know, keeping active, increasing activity levels and exercise are, you know, very often by far the best medicines we have.
As we move towards the back end of this podcast, Alex, I wanted to move on to some of the real practical elements for people who are listening into this podcast. Say I'm a respiratory physician or a nurse or an administrator or somebody working in a resp unit somewhere around the world, and I'm interested in ensuring that my unit does all it can to decarbonize and meet our net zero targets within our trust or our hospital. Where do I start? Where are the toolkits available? You know, how do I go about calculating carbon footprint from my unit? Where do I even begin?
So in terms of resources, I think the Greener Practice website is a great place to start. And they've got some, in particular, their asthma toolkit is fantastic. And they've got some links to other resources as well there. For instance, a guide that we made on low carbon, high quality asthma care. So I'd recommend looking at that. I have a website, greeninhaler.org, which is more patient facing, but includes some information that will be of interest to clinicians as well. And there's some stuff on there about the carbon footprint of different sorts of inhalers. Some useful papers I could mention. You know, we published editorial in British Journal of Clinical Pharmacology last year, which I think is a useful summary. I think there's some good places to start there.
I'm really glad you referenced your website as well, because I've been taking a look at it actually. Theinhaler.org. I encourage you all to actually look at it, whether you are a patient or whether you're a health related professional, because actually there's some really useful strategies to how to explain these concepts to your patients. Alex has done a great job of ensuring and of simplifying how we explain this problem to our patients, and also the nuances, because as you mentioned, it's not as straightforward as dumping metered dose inhalers and completely shifting. And as you said, it's an individualized, patient-centered approach here that we have to take in order to optimize our care and reduce our emissions.
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly for the UK audience, I think we've seen this really dramatic switch over the last 20 years towards pressurized meter dose inhalers. And we've done that to reduce the cost, because historically the pressurized meter dose inhalers have been cheaper than dry powder inhalers. That's probably no longer the case, and you can certainly very often select a more cost-effective dry powder inhaler. But it's also really important that prescribers know how to use these different sorts of inhalers, know how to teach correct inhaler technique, because poor inhaler technique is extremely common, and are able to assess patients' technique and then match the most appropriate device to the patient. So for instance, with metered dose inhalers, it's extremely common to take a hard, fast breath in through the metered dose inhaler. And for those patients, actually, a dry powder inhaler may be more appropriate if it matches their inhalation technique. Being unable to coordinate pressing and breathing is a common problem with the metered dose inhalers. So you may need a breath-actuated metered dose inhaler or a dry powder inhaler to get around that. And then some, I think most patients can be trained to use most inhaler devices, but some patients do struggle to generate the inspiratory flows to use a dry powder inhaler correctly. And do still need pressurized metered dose inhalers. So as you say, it's vital that we've still got them as a treatment option.
I guess to summarize, it's been a really fantastic podcast. What is your message to listeners, both from the respiratory profession and outside of respiratory care, on what needs to be done in terms of respiratory medicine decarbonizing?
So I guess I'd recommend the four principles of being a sustainable physician from Francis Mortimer's classic paper, which perhaps we should reference. But those principles are, firstly, prevention is better than cure. And so action on air pollution and smoking cessation is vital. Patient-centered care, where the patient's involved in decision-making about their care, is vital. Because if you give patients treatments that they don't want, they're not going to use correctly, they can't use, there's going to be a lot of waste with that. Selecting low-carbon options where there are options available. And support for self-management as well, educating patients about their disease so they understand it, they know how to manage it. And therefore they can manage it effectively, in particular with asthma, through anti-inflammatory treatment rather than reliance on bronchodilators. I think these are four key principles applied to respiratory care that can potentially transform both the quality of care that we deliver, but also the environmental impact of our treatments.
Wonderful points there, Alex. Thank you for sharing them. And as you to summarise what you've said there as well, there are so many co-benefits, as you said, to decarbonising here, and additional benefits for the health of our patients as well around the world. When you talked about some of those strategies, including smoking cessation, exercise, pulmonary rehabilitation, and just long-term improvement in inflammatory the inflammatory situation of our respiratory health. So thank you very much for sharing all those points today and joining us on the podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me along. It's been great to talk.